When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And it's Kluivert who's arrived as danger here. Kluivert! Oh, he's missed it. Dalton lost it there. Here's Zenden. Oh. Overmars with the shot, and Gibbon has to parry it away. Overmars, tipped by Gary Kelly.
He could get sent off if he's not Kelly. I think
yes,
he's gone.
He is, he's gone. Oh. Duff in close attendance. Keane is fouled. Duff helping it on towards Finnan. Finnan facing Cuckoo. And a little cross in there, and it's come through here. McAteer!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Jonathan Wilson is with me, of course. And with us is Dion Fanning, presenter of Ireland Unfiltered and writer for Joe. Dion, pleasure to have you on the pod.
Great to be here, guys.
Yeah, well, it's great to be here because we're in Dublin.
We are.
We're recording in Dublin, of course. Now, for this podcast, we go back to a World Cup qualifier in 2001. It was Ireland 1, Netherlands 0. Of course it was. Dion, why did you choose this game?
This is a defining game, I think, in the history of Irish football. It is, I would describe it as the end of innocence. It was the last time that Irish football felt united and all moving in the same direction, harnessing the kind of the the great aspects of the Irish football and then the kind of wildness. It was one of the last great games, or one of the most notable last great games in the old Lands End Road, because Ireland entered into a trough after that. But it was a wild day, which in my memory of it is kind of, you know, a great performance by the Ireland team, and then you look back on it and you're like, you know, there was nobody played any
fortuitous, maybe.
Nobody played any football here. But because of what there are moments in it in the context of the game, there were moments in there's a famous picture taken by photographer Rain O'Sullivan at the end of the game when Ireland won, of Roy Keane walking off the pitch and Mick McCarthy running on to celebrate, and Keane just heading down the tunnel despite this famous Ireland victory, and McCarthy stretching out to shake Keane's hand, and Keane half-heartedly leaning back and touching hands, and this became because this group had taken place with this undercurrent that Keane and McCarthy didn't get on, and this was disputed and dealt with in the classic kind of cliche terms of football. We don't all have to be best friends to have a successful football team. But this was September 2001, and then we know what happened in May 2002. So the straight line between this and Saipan, and then everything, for what it's worth, in Irish football has essentially been living the same day over and over again since then, because as we sit here, Mick McCarthy is the Ireland manager again. John Delaney, who rose to prominence on the back of Saipan, is finally disgraced because of his behaviour as chief executive of the FAI. So this seems like a moment when, for the last time, the golden age of Irish football, which, and we'll get into this maybe as a backstory, the golden age of Irish football was kind of coming to an end, because there was a golden age between 1988 and 1994. And this really does mark the end of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a strong start. I mean, it was an incredible game, which we'll talk about in a bit. But you know, Ireland at the time, they you know, as Dion says, there was that golden age.
Well, it's interesting you're saying that, because it's also, it's the end of, I don't know if it's the end of innocence for Dutch football, but certainly the end of something for Dutch football.
Yeah.
That the great Van Gaal Ajax team in 95... they should have been reaching maturity here. Mm. And yet you look at that starting lineup, not many of them in that team. And obviously two of them are serving drugs bans.
Yeah.
The Frank de Boer and Edgar Davids. Edgar Davids was actually at the game in the stand, were banned for having, yeah, they had high anabolic levels, which I don't think the truth that's ever quite been teased out, but they certainly served a ban.
They did.
It's not Van Gaal's Ajax, but in orange shirts. It's not what the Dutch of 74 were, that they were the great young Ajax wearing orange and, you know, with a couple of final players to bolster it and a couple of PSV players.
And then they end the game, Holland end the game famously with four strikers on the field. It's just like Van Gaal having abandoned every principle and just said, let me find any strikers at all I can see, any fours, we'll just put them all on because we'll score somehow.
Yeah, well, I think in Van Gaal's, obviously we're going to focus on Ireland more here, but I think Van Gaal's position here is, it's sort of the end of his innocence, that he's had the very successful time at Ajax. Mm. He's been really battered at Barcelona despite not doing too badly there. And this, I think, is when he really starts to... He'd started to doubt his principles towards the end of Barcelona, the end of his first spell at Barcelona, that he'd started to toy with playing with a proper back three and wing backs, because he'd realised that when teams were overloading against them, they needed to get more players high up the pitch. And this, you know, he plays essentially a 4-2-3-1. It's not the 4-3-3. He's playing Kluivert just off Van Nistelrooy, but they occupy the same space on the pitch and get in each other's way. And that's not... That's not Van Gaal at all. Van Gaal's all about positioning. It's all about getting the spread across the pitch.
But do you think he panicked going into that game then? Because the Dutch needed a win in a group that contained Portugal, obviously Ireland, Netherlands, Estonia, Cyprus and Andorra. So there's three easy ones there. It was always going to be Portugal, Ireland and Netherlands.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'd slightly misremembered the game, and in my head it was the final qualifier, but it's not, is it?
It's
because Ireland still had
played Cyprus at home.
Yeah.
Which, you know,
a draw was going to be enough, but there was still just a chance if they won, they could pick Portugal for top of the group.
But if they lost, they were out.
Yeah,
Yes, so it was a very,
which
very
nobody,
crucial.
Which Van Gaal didn't really consider. Like, he was asked about, when he was asked about the prospect of defeat before the game, he answered it in terms of Ireland. Yeah. He answered in terms of what it would mean for Ireland if they lost.
So sounded like Van Gaal to behave in such a manner. But you know, the Netherlands, of course, 98, reached the semi-final, only just pipped by Brazil in the semis on penalties. Euro 2000, got to the semis again, but really were disappointed.
And lost on penalties.
Had lost on penalties and were disappointed that they should have got past Italy in that semi.
But there was a sense of the time the Dutch were one of the great teams.
Exactly.
One of the great teams in waiting. They hadn't quite done it. They've twice been denied, as you say, in very close semi-finals.
Yeah. And would I be right in saying that Ireland hadn't qualified for a major since 94?
That's right, yeah. Well, Ireland had this run where they qualified between 88 and 94 for three out of four competitions.
Which their first ever tournament. Yeah,
and then they missed out in 92, but there was three out of four, so there was this sense of expectation. And then they missed out in 96 losing to the Dutch at Anfield in the playoff, which was Jack Charlton's last game. And then Mick McCarthy came in and tried to change things. Even though he was seen as the son of Jack, he tried to change things. He played three at the back, most infamously, if you like, playing Roy Keane as a centre-half against Iceland when... some journalists encouraged the crowd to boo Keane because he hadn't been showing up for Ireland matches. So Keane was booed by a section of the Ireland supporters in that game. They didn't qualify. Missed out in a playoff to Belgium in 97. In 99, Ireland were leading in Macedonia with, I think, 11 seconds to go. And if they'd held on, they would have qualified. And Macedonia scored from a corner. Ireland went on to a playoff, two-legged playoff against Turkey, the second leg, which was held in Bursa to make things as difficult as possible for the FAI, who presumably didn't look to kind of charter a plane. I was on that trip, and I remember we flew to Istanbul, then got a hovercraft. I'm serious. A hovercraft across the Sea of Marmara. And then drove for an hour and a half to Bursa. And we were on the same, we were with the players. And I clearly, so obviously Ireland lost. That game ended in a mass brawl on the field. Tony Cascarino was sent off. And I remember making the reverse journey that night after the game and touching down in Dublin Airport at 5 or 6 in the morning and standing beside Roy Keane on the bus taking us from the plane back to the terminal. And I remember looking at Keane and thinking, I wonder, like, what could I say to you here that would just lead to like an incredible, because I've never seen, you know, that face of thunder.
Yeah, which we're all too familiar with.
Yeah, can you imagine what it's like after a 9-hour train journey by bus, hovercraft and plane? And then you get to the airport and then you've got to actually...
Anybody fancy breakfast at Harry Ramsay's?
And then you've got to get a bus. They don't even have anything waiting for you. It's just like you get on the bus with everyone else.
Yeah.
So in that context, Ireland went into these World Cup qualifiers and they were drawn, you know, you say that there were three teams in it, but they're drawn against Holland and Portugal.
Yeah.
It seemed like impossible for Ireland. Uh-huh. And then their first, the way the fixtures were negotiated, they played Holland and Portugal away first in their first two games.
But should have won, really, in Amsterdam.
They should have won.
Because Ireland were unbeaten in that group.
Yeah.
They won 7 and drew 3, same as Portugal.
Yeah, no, they were.
It was impressive.
No, they were very impressive. But the team was coming together. He had brought in Robbie Keane and Damien Duff towards the end of the... they made their debuts in 98, but they came through in the campaign before that. Keane came through quicker than Duff, but... But he was by the end of that campaign, he'd started with Duff and Keane up front, and they were coming through. There was a bit of excitement about the Irish team, and then Keane, like when we talk about the end of innocence, you're also talking about the final 2 years of Keane as the player. As you know, he got his injury subsequently. He got the injury that he went when he his hip injury, and when he was sent off at Sunderland in 2002. he had
with Jason McAteer.
Jason
McAteer learns to write.
Yeah. and Niall Quinn walks out to shake Roy Keane's hand to make peace on the sideline, and Alex Ferguson tells him to fuck off. Another great day in the history of Irish football. At that moment, but anyway, Keane had that hip operation because he was suspended, and when he came back, he was never the same player. So these last 2 years, between 2000 and what we thought was going to be the peak in 2002 at the World Cup, this was Keane in his prime. He had
This game, I think I'm saying, was his ninth last competitive international.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary, really, when you think about it. I mean, he would have been, 31 in this game?
Yeah, 31. But you see, even again then, we go to the playoff, and you're jumping around a bit, but you go to the playoff, and the great advantage of this group was that the playoff wasn't a European playoff. It was a playoff against an Asian team, so there was seen as a greater chance of qualifying. But even that then became, shrouded in this sort of air of what is the relationship between Keane and the rest of the players, because Ireland win the first leg against Iran in Dublin 2-0.
It's Ciro Blazovic's Iran.
Yeah.
Well, not any old Iran. Iran managed by a bonkers old Croat, Bosnian Croat.
And Keane decides that the second leg is too much for his body and doesn't travel to Tehran, and leaves on the Sunday morning after the Ireland play on Saturday night in Dublin. And on the Sunday morning, he leaves. And when the players come up and wake up, Keane is already gone, and he sees it as totally justifiable. They've got a positive result. He's not able to play these. He's nursing himself at this stage, but again, there is this division, and that directly leads to Saipan and the hotel ballroom and Mick McCarthy talking about picking and choosing your games, which Keane reacts furiously to. So this is the last moment when there is at least the pretense of unity. And there is Keane at for various different reasons, at in his prime. He is seen as, and you talk about the Holland game, to go back on that, when Ireland threw that away, there was still a lot of delight. McCarthy was very happy.
Is it 2-0 up or 25 minutes ago?
2-0 up, yeah. And McCarthy came out afterwards and stressed how positive this was. Keane came out afterwards and said, we need to start giving ourselves a bit more credit. So there was this classic Keane caricature in some ways being formed of Keane, the professional, Keane, the person who always wants more, Keane, who isn't happy to go along for, the sing-song. It was a cliche. I don't think it really got to the truth of what Keane was about, and but I think there were the way he was changing in his personal life was probably had more of a profound effect on what he was doing, because and I've written I've written about this in the Blizzard, the Keane and his relationship with drink was altering hugely over these years as well, and he was becoming somebody who, having drunk to excess, was removing it from his life. He drunk, and his drinking was to such an extreme that, Alex Ferguson at Manchester United said if anybody is seen drinking with Roy Keane tonight, I will fine them. So that's, you're talking about the captain. Like, we look back on it now and it seems crazy, kind of, but that's what was happening as with the captain of Manchester United. He was coming through that. He was changing. And I believe that this idea of him, the ultra professional who doesn't celebrate draws, or even after the Holland game, is heading down the tunnel. That was more to do with Keane trying to maintain an equilibrium in his personal life than being the arch professional, being the person who sets the standards. Because on the back of this, Ireland went crazy with this idea of Keane was seen as an emblem, not just for a changing football team, but for a changing country. We are now the Celtic Tiger. We are making money. We're no longer just the poor man of Europe. And Roy Keane, you would read these takes, regularly, that Roy Keane's demand for ultra professionalism is in the vanguard of this changing Ireland. And when in fact, I think it was part performative, because Keane liked this idea of the person who was never satisfied, and it was part just psychological from his own point of view, just to keep things on an equilibrium, which he was doing at that stage imperfectly, and then when he got to Saipan, the equilibrium didn't last.
It was smashed into bits. All right, let's have a quick break, and then after which we'll talk about the match.
Kakuta try and shoot. Here's Van Nistelrooy, give it out of his goal. Van Nistelrooy's denied. And side net. Side net from Kluivert. Oh, well, two big misses from him today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to the Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Now then, gentlemen, we come to the match itself. It was a pleasant day in Dublin, and the if you look at the team sheets, as you've already said, Dion, you know, it's a decent Ireland team, but it was a decent Dutch side as well.
Well, it's not that decent Dutch side,
but
Rysik is injured as well.
But some of the personnel they've got in there.
Yeah, but one of them's Kevin Hofland, so it was not that decent a side.
But you've got Van der Sar, Jaap Stam, Van Bommel, Cocu, Kluivert, Van Nistelrooy, Overmars.
I mean,
it's not that bad, is
no,
it?
No, it's a good side.
It's a side that probably should win the game.
Yeah, but I guess my point is it's not. It's yeah. In 1995, when Ajax won the Champions League, mm-hmm. and if you'd said to somebody, "Pick me your ideal Dutch team going into the third last qualifier for the 2002 World Cup," this isn't the team they pick.
No.
So look at the Ireland team. It's a good team.
It is, but that Dutch side shouldn't. Okay, well, we'll go. So the match. I mean, were people in Ireland hopeful, Dion, going into this match, or were they a little bit wary of the Dutch threat, so to speak?
I think they were hopeful, but because I think there was always, especially at that time, there was always hope. Like Ireland had got traditionally got good results at Lansdowne Road. They had beaten Yugoslavia a couple of years before. They'd beaten Croatia. You know, they did beat teams at Lansdowne Road. And there was just that sense of it was an intimidating, it was a really unpleasant place to play.
Yeah, but they had those games that you spoke about in the first half, the playoffs, the disappointments, hadn't qualified for a tournament for a few tournaments. Yeah. So that's in the back of the mind, is it not?
Well, it is. It is. And it, you know, and when we get into the game, you like, you know, the way it went, but it'll probably confirm those fears, because but there was always a sense, and this lingered for years after this, you know, whenever, like, when Ireland, as I said, you know, hit a trough after this, or went into a trough where these games didn't happen, this game would always be clung to as evidence before a big match that, you know, anything can happen at Lansdowne Road.
Is it just me, or was the pitch terrible?
The pitch was, but this was, the pitch was, this was, again, in my memory, the pitch had improved. Like, I used to go to Ireland matches during the Jack Charlton era, and we used to have, I remember myself and my brother used to go early, and we always had this dream that one day the pitch would look like, would look beautiful, and it would be like an actual football pitch. And, you know, you would go, you would walk into Lansdowne Road before the match, and you would see this ploughed field. And that's how it was in the Jack. But Jack wanted that.
Mm. Yeah.
Jack hated
he
the
ploughed idea. Himself.
He hated the idea that a visiting team would show up and look at something and think, look at the pitch and they go, oh God, we're going to enjoy playing on this. He wanted the pitch to be the first signal that this was going to be a really, really unpleasant afternoon.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go back to those games. You go back to when Ireland played Spain in 89 when they won 1-0, and you look at it and it's horrendous. Mm. Like, it's just, it's appalling. So by those standards, this was...
But I reckon about half a chance in the game caused by the pitch.
Yeah.
There's a bit, I mean, I guess we'll get into it in more detail, but there's a bit in the second half when Ireland play sort of four or five passes in their own half. Jim Beglin on the commentary going, who do we think we are? Brazil?
Yeah. Well, Beglin's
And then Richard Dunn stumbles over the ball.
Yeah.
Not just because he's Richard Dunn, but because the ball's kind of bounced about 6 feet in the air off some bobble.
Yeah. I mean, there's various points that Jim Beglin has kittens in that game.
But there was a confidence,
yes,
because of what they had, you know, what they had done in that group. And as you say, they were unbeaten in that group. And there was this sense, like when Ireland played Portugal in June, Keane was extraordinary that day. Keane was fantastic against Holland, but against Portugal that day, I don't think I've ever seen a more complete performance from a midfielder. He scored, he did everything. He really did everything. And nobody really, the difference with the Holland game was that other players like Duff and Keane, and Robbie Keane, Duff especially, kind of rose to his standards, where against Portugal, he did everything. And it was really like extraordinary performance. And, you know, and that came on the back of a 4-0 win in Cyprus, where Keane had, you know, away in Cyprus, where Keane had scored twice and spent the entire game. I remember somebody doing player ratings for that game, and all the player ratings were based entirely on how many times Keane had bollocked each of them.
Yeah.
Because that's what he spent. He scored twice and then spent the rest of the game just getting on everybody's case the entire time. And so there was this sense that while he was there, anything was possible. And, you know, the standards were, he had given an interview before the Cyprus game to Paul Kimmage where he attacked the FAI for being in first class while they were in economy and all these kind of things. So these standards were rising. He had, this came out subsequently, but when they played in Holland, he had attacked the professionalism of Ireland's setup the night before the game, because they were in the team hotel in Amsterdam, and they were all given cheese sandwiches to eat. And Keane exploded at this and uttered the famous line, to Mick McCarthy, do you think Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank is eating fucking cheese sandwiches tonight?
So good, isn't it? Yeah.
Which there's no answer to.
No. You know? Yeah. But he had,
because he isn't.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, we're getting to Keenan even more so in a short while. But he has some fair points, though, or fair gripes, shall we say.
Well, Keane sort of is then responsible for the first action of a game.
Yes.
He puts in this reducer on Mark Overmars, to which then brilliantly Mark Van Bommel responds by putting in a reducer on Kevin Kilbane. Which isn't quite like for like.
No, it's not. And
well, if you're going to hit one of our small and defenceless ones, then we'll do the same to you.
Yeah. But I think, but also that shapes the game, not just in the sense of releasing this kind of wildness into the atmosphere, because it's 30 seconds into the game, the crowd are fired up, and the first thing that happens is Keane doing this, and he'd be sent off today.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's him trying to take the lead, isn't it? That's him putting.
It's equivalent of Vinnie Jones on Steve McMahon.
Yes, exactly.
But then you see that the player who's most angry about this is Patrick Kluivert, who's furious at this foul and is shouting at the referee and is led away by the Dutch players from the referee. And minutes, seconds later, Cliver has the first chance. Well, and people,
Gary Kelly is tackled by the pitch.
Yeah.
Presenting the ball.
Yeah. But friend, I know people who insist that Cliver's brain was still scrambled by the Overmars tackle.
Yeah.
And because, you know, the pitch also plays a part in him missing it, but it's such a simple chance.
Yeah.
By so Cliver.
Gary Kelly, right back, loses the ball, partly because he's sort of, the pitch has sort of taken it away from him. Cliver bursts in the box. He's sort of to the left side of the box, but he's essentially could go either side of the keeper. And it's a classic sort of Cliver rolled finish, except it rolls 2 or 3 feet wide.
Hmm.
And the pitch, and I think his...
And I even think that miss, I don't know, it's easy to say in hindsight, but you must start to think, if Cliver's missing them, maybe it's our day,
Well, it's one of those ones, isn't it, as you say, that the better side have a glorious opportunity and they don't take it. And they need to win the game.
Hmm.
So suddenly there's that extra pressure of, is it going to be one of those days for us?
Yeah, they need to win the game, and Ireland are okay with a draw. But
yes.
Ireland still did have the chance of topping the group and not needing the playoff.
Hmm.
So they needed the win for that.
Yes.
So I'm sure they'd have taken the draw.
Yeah.
Because Mick McCarthy would take a 1-1 draw in any circumstance.
He'd have bitten your hand off.
Yeah. Even if it meant finishing
20 years later, he's still biting
your hand off 1-1 draws.
1-1 draws. So nothing has changed. As you say, everything, you know, it's the same day in Irish football over and over again. But except this time they win.
Yes. But so Cliver misses that chance. And then soon after.
It's a Zenden chance.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is a long ball over the top.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say Steve Staunton's exposed as a centre-back?
Well, this is the other thing, because Staunton had come in as a centre-back against Portugal because Gary Breen...
A 1-1 draw.
Yeah, a 1-1 draw, which he bit your hand off. But Staunton came in and played centre-back and, you know, was rusty and shaky and sort of managed to kind of stumble through it. And again, that was the story of this match too, you know, where you're looking at the centre-backs going, there is no chance that these centre-backs keep this Dutch team out. And then, you know, as you say, like a long ball where Zenden, again, and that's a great chance as well.
But it is well,
again, Jim Beglin on the commentary says that he thinks it was a worse miss than the Cliver one. So it's a long ball. Zenden, the ball bounces up quite nicely for him. So
it gives him only one option.
The pitch isn't even an excuse. Given's come too far, he's in no man's land.
Yeah.
Just knock it over him. And Shea Given... Is he 6 foot? If he's 6 foot, he's only just 6 foot.
6 foot, yeah.
He's not.
He's one of these people who says they're 6 foot.
Yeah,
but they're probably five foot eleven.
I wrote him off during his loan spell at Sunderland. But he kept in like 9 clean sheets in a row, and then he was responsible for 2 goals at Watford, scored in a 3-3 draw at Vicarage Road.
Yeah,
and he basically every time Watford lumped the ball in the box, he panicked, and I thought that young man's not going to make it. And I think I was vindicated.
At Sunderland, he wouldn't have made. Yeah, right.
And Zenden just sort of half-heartedly sort of side foots it into his chest.
Yeah.
But again, though, after those two chances, and they come in pretty quick succession, and it's fairly sort of early on in the first half, Ireland are thinking, oh, we got away with another one. And again, what is the Dutch mentality there? They're thinking, all right, well, we should get more. But then, of course,
the semi-final against Italy a year earlier starts to play on their mind.
Well, this is it.
Because the same thing happened there. They missed chance after chance after chance after chance. By the end, they couldn't score a penalty.
Yeah.
And once that's happened to you once, it must get at you that, oh, God, we're doing it again.
Uh-huh. I don't think Ireland threatened that much in the first half.
I mean, the only other chance in the first half was Richard Dunn giving it away to Overmars.
Mm.
And then Given actually makes a really good save, low to his left. And also Van Nistelrooy's coming in. He manages to push it away from Van Nistelrooy.
That's right.
So I'm mocking Given, but that's actually a really, really good save.
Yeah, that was a good save. No, but
that's it in the first half. Ireland don't threaten. The Dutch should be at least a goal up.
Yeah.
That is the first half, really. And so, again, you get in a half time.
But that was, as you say, like the, you know, from the position of biting your hand off for a draw, this was now Ireland will be blessed to get out of this game.
Absolutely.
Because even though you, in hindsight, we say, okay, this puts doubt in the Dutch's mind. But like the fact
it's
that.
Putting doubt in the Irish
mind. Putting doubt in the Irish mind that they were contributing so greatly to every Dutch chance that there was just this sense of. Mm. There was this sort of shambolic defending at all times. You're going to think, this is not going to last.
Yeah.
But the one thing, again, that is this, and even though there aren't chances, the one thing that is becoming the other story of the game is Keane doing that thing that Keane does, which is every, you know, just that the intelligence he had as a footballer, which, you know, was underestimated a lot at the time, just to take the sting out of situations, to take the ball forward, to hold on to possession, to keep possession, whether that was sometimes by running with the ball for 20 or 30 yards, or just keeping simple, you know, making simple passes and make keeping things moving. And that in itself begins to sort of change the atmosphere of the game, because he has an intelligence, again, that was overlooked, to do that, to actually understand what is required. So it's what is required now is calmness and coolness, and we can't, you know, there is enough panic. You know, look at our team, we were panicking all over the place. I need to, you know, just reduce the panic, and that's what he does. And it reduces the panic because of what he's doing, and then it gives an air of assurance and calmness to the teammates, to the crowd, and that is the thing that begins to develop over the game then as well.
And it's very rare for any national side, especially one of the, in terms of population, especially smaller nations, to have a player like that who can really almost kind of, if you like, grab the atmosphere by the scruff of the neck, if you see what I mean.
And alter it.
Yes, absolutely. So we go into the second half. And
I mean, just sorry, talking about Roy Keane. Yeah. I might as well tell my Roy Keane story again.
Go on.
Just in case anybody left in the world who hasn't heard it. But Roy Keane changed the atmosphere.
Yeah.
When he was manager of Sunderland, there was a game away at Cardiff. And I think it was in the March. And it was we get to Cardiff, it's a bright sunny day. It's quite a nice spring day. 2:45, the clouds roll in. Like, it's black as sky, you can imagine. The wind's got up. It's like 60, 70 mile an hour gusts. And Sunderland have the wind in the first half, playing with the wind. Cardiff can't get out of their half. They literally cannot kick the ball hard enough to get out of their half. And Sunderland do not score. And you think, oh, no way are we going to hold out. And second half, Cardiff absolutely batter Sunderland. And Sunderland can't get out of their own box. And Johnny Evans is magnificent, you know, taking the ball down, passing it out. And then Roy Keane, who's in one of those phases when he had the big, bushy Prospero beard, wanders out to the edge of a technical area. And I was sitting next to you and Roberts in the press box, and we both saw it happen. We both talked to each other about it after. We both saw it. He stared at the clouds till the clouds parted. He didn't just change the atmosphere, he literally changed the weather. The clouds parted, the wind dropped. He put on 4'2" Ross Wallace, who scores the winner.
Yeah.
And I came out of the ground going, we're not just going to get promoted, we're going to solve global warming. It's like, Roy Keane can do anything.
Well, I did a lot of Sunderland games that year when Sunderland got promoted with Keane there. And one of, you know, it wasn't opening the clouds, but one of my favourite moments was at home against QPR. And QPR got a free kick, and the fullback did the player was fouled, and the fullback did the usual thing of throwing the ball 10 yards further forward than where the foul was. And, you know, convention says that the referee spots it, and, you know, you bring it back to where the foul actually took place. Keane jumped out of the dugout, screamed at the player, saying, put it back! The fullback went up, picked up the ball, and put it back to where it had to go.
Fantastic.
So that was, you know, and at that point, yeah, so even like that Sunderland, it did seem, and we are really jumping ahead, but that year, I felt, and I remember
the number of games Sunderland turned around in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, the Southampton.
Southampton 3-2, when Carlos Edwards scored a brilliant goal. Yeah. Burnley even. Mm. Like David Connolly, the bravest man in the world, missed a penalty in the first half, took another one in the second half, and thankfully for him, scored it.
But Barnsley away, didn't work down in that game, but they scored. Did they score late in Barnsley when they left Stokes? That was my other story.
Tony Stokes.
My other story of that season was because Keane left. Sunderland left Stokes and a couple of other players behind because they were late for the bus.
Oh yeah, that was Barnsley.
Yeah. And of course Keane, and again Keane's history with McCarthy also includes a story from when Keane was a player and was a drinking, you know, member of the drinking school in the Ireland team, and they were on a US tour, and he was late for the bus that was leaving, and he you know, and some of this is apocryphal, as Keane has acknowledged, but he got on the bus late, and He may have been wearing a kind of scarf and, you know, a little Ireland hat and things like this. And anyway, McCarthy is said to have said to him, call yourself a professional. What are you doing? Call yourself a professional. To which Keane is said to have replied, call what you have a first touch. So anyway, he misses this, but he's late for this bus. So when he left behind the the players at Sunderland, you know, some of us noticed that there was a change in approach here. I remember mentioning it to one of the journalists in the press room before the press conference that day in Barnes. You know, Keane missed a bus himself. So Keane walks in. First question is, Roy, you know, you left the players behind. You yourself have missed a bus once or twice, haven't you? And Keane again turns to him, eyes narrow. Are you calling me a hypocrite? And spends 10 minutes explaining to this journalist why he's not a hypocrite, why even to suggest it would be, you know, one of the most pathetic things you could ever do as a human being. And this, you know, demolition of the character of the journalist who has asked this question, whilst by the end of the answer, actually kind of admitting that he had missed the bus himself. But this, you know, humiliation of the journalist. And I remember, you know, Keane walked out of the press room and the journalist just looked at me and went, thanks for that.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, back on the pitch at Lansdowne Road in 2001, not that long after half time, it was sort of 10, 15 minutes, Ireland are reduced to 10 men.
And yeah, it's Gary Kelly goes to the back of Overmars.
Yeah.
Absolute nailed on second yellow.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about the sort of the calmness, despite all those stories, the calmness that Keane is trying to sort of foster within that team on that day. Well, the nerves and the panic must have been raised a level or two after they're down to 10 men.
Well, yeah, look at what Steve Staunton did next.
Yeah. Yeah.
They've got about, what is it, sort of half an hour or more to play against the side who are battering them, quite frankly.
Yeah. And, well, no, that's it. And the mood at that stage is, can Ireland, again, not, there has been nothing apart from Keane, really, and maybe Damien Duff that suggests that anything other than clinging on is possible with 11 men. Now,
well, yeah, at half time, you'd probably take a draw.
Yeah.
When that happens, you're thinking, oh, bloody hell. You know, a draw would feel like the greatest win of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's because of the strength of the Dutch, you just think that a goal is inevitable. It does seem like a goal is inevitable.
And Steve Staunton does his best to give it.
He does,
So it begins with this sort of six pass in their own half that Jim Beglin's so furious about. Richard Dunn is a, it's not a great pass to him, but his first touch is McCarthy-esque, shall we say.
Richard Dunn's first touch on that pitch.
Yeah.
You can fill in the...
The ball is lost. And then it's chipped forward and the pass is far too hard. It's Shea Given coming out, is going to get there. Except Steve Staunton goes running back in. A courageous diving header past his own keeper.
Yeah. It's kind of like, there's something kind of... It's like the... Pelé's dummy in 1970, but you know, in a kind of, you know, let's play this one for laughs and as defenders.
Yeah, so he nods the ball beyond Given. It's trickling possibly towards the goal in that very much that danger zone. Van Nistelrooy nips in.
Yeah, Shea Given, as he stands up, blocks Van Nistelrooy, which might be a foul. Well, yes. And then they stumble over, and Given pulls him down for sure.
And Jim Beglin's initial commentary, he says, he doesn't think that Shea Given was deliberately bringing...
Well, George Hamilton straight away goes, that's unbelievable. And he's just so silent for sort of 5 seconds. The ball is sort of hoofed away for a corner, and the referee just hasn't given...
An obvious penalty. Yeah. Like it is extraordinary.
It's a penalty and sending off.
It is a penalty and sending off. And how, when you think of the outrage in Ireland when Henri's handball knocked Ireland out of the World Cup.
Wow, Robbie Keane's handball against Armenia doesn't get talked about.
No, it doesn't. No, okay. No. But this doesn't get talked about.
It's almost like hypocrisy at the root of football.
Are you calling them hypocrites?
Yes.
This never gets talked about. This was a clear penalty. It was how, when you look at it again, how is this not like there, you know? It's like Shea Given couldn't have been more clear in his intent to foul him if he just admitted it to the referee and said, watch me take him out. But Ireland get away with it.
And at 0-0.
Yeah.
At 0-0. And again, the Dutch must just be thinking, Van Gaal is losing his mind on the sideline now. So as I say,
In hindsight, you see that Ireland got Van Gaal at exactly the right time. Late Van Gaal wasn't as angry. Late Van Gaal mellowed a bit.
See, that tells you, ladies and gentlemen, just how angry he was back then.
So this was him where he sort of, everything started to go against him at Barcelona. And he is absolutely raging that, I mean, everything is going wrong. Yeah. It's not really his fault. I mean, that's a penalty.
No, it's a penalty.
He's watched three of the best players in the world miss simple chances.
Yeah.
What's he meant to do?
Yeah.
Send on more strikers.
Yeah, well, that's what he did.
Which he duly did. But then, of course, lo and behold, a few minutes after all this, Ireland go up the pitch. And there's the ball's down the right, and I forget who puts the ball in.
Keane takes the ball about 30 yards down the left-hand side. And again, showing his passing and his ability was always kind of underrated, I think, for United and for Ireland. But he draws this thing out of a Dutch attack, and then actually creates... Uh-huh. Starts an Irish attack and it makes its way over to...
Well, he plays as Damien Duff. Finnan's come forward from right. Finnan's come on when Kelly went off. But I presume Robbie Keane went off from, did he? Is that the change they made?
I think that's right, isn't it?
So Finnan runs onto it, chips over defence and
the defence are just not there. McAteer is...
Melchior had started at... Yeah, Melchior was playing at right back, wasn't he? And Newman at left back. So Melchior has, for some reason, moved right into the centre.
Well, probably because he thinks there's no threat.
And Jason McAteer, who I can't quite work out what the reorganisation must have been, because McAteer starts off playing on the right side of midfield.
McAteer hadn't started a game for Blackburn for 5 months at that stage.
Right.
It was a classic Irish player who's wasn't playing football.
Yeah.
So, like, if the Dutch forgot about him, it was probably understandable.
We're talking about... Irish football and drink. One of the very first jobs I had in journalism was to go up to a place on the Wirral where McAteer was coaching his brother's Sunday League team, and so the job was to go up and just interview McAteer as he coaches his brother's team. McAteer's dad turned up, who's a character, as you can imagine, this kind of old kind of Scouse Irish boxer, like face all over the place, the filthiest jokes you ever heard. And in the midst of its interview, McAteer, I sort of said, what happened at Liverpool? How come you decided, how come you left? What went wrong with Ullier? And he said, he was getting this in on a Sunday morning. That was just getting in the way of my drinking. It's like, you do know I'm recording this and going to print it, right? Well, yeah, but it's true, People might as well know. Basically, all I want to do is have a job and have enough money I can go out and get lashed with my mates on a Saturday night. But Gerard was getting us in at 9:30 on a Sunday, so I couldn't do that anymore. And I thought, it's not for me. And I see, people would say to you, kind of, you've got this great talent that, loads and loads of people would give anything to have your talent to be a professional footballer at a club like Liverpool. And they would think, knocking and drinking on the head for 12 years or whatever your career is, that's a worthwhile sacrifice. And well, they can think that. That's not what I think. So I'd rather play at a lower club, but keep on being able to live my life as I want. And I sort of thought, yeah, I do get that.
Yeah.
And then he said to me, and this is, to be fair to Jason McAteer, famously not that bright, but it is a good point. He said, he told me you've never gotten to work hungover. Well, no, I can't tell you that. He said, what's the difference?
Yeah, the other thing is as well, the 9:30, it wasn't a coincidence that Ullier introduced the 9:30 on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Sure,
yeah.
Let's just start.
Anyways, that's why he's at Blackburn. Yeah. And Finnan's chip pass comes to him, and it's a beautiful finish.
It's a stunning finish.
He's completely on his own.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show how confident the Dutch were and how non-existent the Irish threat was of scoring a goal, because it wasn't 11 with 11 men, let alone 10. Completely unmarked and sort of on the half volley, if you will.
I think it is. I think you call that half volley.
Yeah, and side foots it beautifully into the corner.
Yeah.
It's one of those ones where if he put it over the bar, you'd think, it would be an easy one to sky, but it's a wonderful finish. And the place erupts.
Yeah.
It goes absolutely mad. They cannot believe that they've sort of picked the pocket here.
And that's where you see Lansdowne Road at its best.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stand behind that goal.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I remember seeing it in football, seeing it in rugby, just thinking, what a place to be, that stand must be.
No, it was. And it was just, again, it was alive. There was a kind of a unity about it. There was just this wildness everywhere. Like this, as you say, they'd picked the pocket of the Dutch team. the sort of the incredulity of what people were witnessing was sort of shared by everybody. You know, the players, nobody expected this. And then, the rest of the game becomes this sort of wild defiance that Ireland are going to kind of, hold on.
But I guess even with the knowledge that even if you let in one,
yeah,
it's a 1-1 draw, which you'd have bitten the hand off.
But then, of course,
there is one more really good Dutch chance. Yeah. There's a Cocu shot that he doesn't really catch. Sort of bobbles through to Van Nistelrooy, who his touch takes him slightly wide, which means Given's able to get on top of him, blocks the shot. It's then worked back into the middle. And I still don't know how Kluivert misses that. Kluivert's sort of 6-7 yards out. The cross is slightly behind him, and somehow he drags it just wide of the post.
It's slightly tricky, but again, the player of his quality should score.
And then that goes back again to Van Gaal and his helplessness, because you Kluivert, the game is bookended by two extraordinary misses from Kluivert, which change everything.
Yeah, and every kind of clearance out away from the Ireland box is greeted with, like it was another goal.
But that's what we're used to. That's fine.
Absolutely.
And the thing is, you know then that the kind of, you put the ball out of play, the crowd holds the ball for 10-15 seconds. It's 10-15 seconds gone. You don't get that time back.
But it's one of those things in football, sometimes when you see something happen, when Ireland score, you just think, well, this will finish 1-0. It's easy to say that, as a non-Irishman and with hindsight, of course. But just the inevitability, and I think that's it. It all just came crashing down for the Dutch. They themselves are in full panic mode then. The home crowd are absolutely loving every kick away and so on. And they get over the line. And as you say,
Van Gaal just chucking the forwards on.
Yeah.
Is an admission of defeat. The philosopher king has abandoned philosophy.
Yeah.
I mean, four forwards, Hasselbank, Van Nistelrooy, Kluivert, and who would be the other one?
Oh, I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, presumably you've got Zenden and Omar. I don't know what.
Van Hooijdonk.
Van Hooijdonk, yes, of course. Yeah, I'm just thinking maybe Roy Mackay, but yeah, he was the unlucky man who didn't get on.
Amazingly.
Yeah, if you're a Dutch striker and you didn't get on that day, you'd take that personally, I think, wouldn't you? But they were all on and they couldn't get through, and the final whistle goes and it's jubilation. You know, it's as you say, it's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, wins in the history of Irish football. Well, not the greatest, but certainly one of the greatest.
Well, I think, but again, because of the context of it, because of where Irish football had been, between 88 and 94, and then where they'd been trying to get back to, and suddenly, like, this was really McCarthy's last chance at qualifying. And people had mixed feelings about Mick McCarthy then, but this was, a team that had grown used to qualifying. Suddenly, now there was actually a pathway to the World Cup, because you felt a playoff, to beat Cyprus at home, and then there was a playoff against a team that Ireland would fancy their chances against, which was not the case in the three previous playoffs. So this was the moment where you think, actually, have Ireland qualified for the World Cup? Keane's reaction was kind of like, this is just 3 points, while the entire country was celebrating. He was kind of thinking, well, we've only got this again, but again in that performative way, and as I feel in a kind of a way of him keeping himself on an even keel, it was his way of saying, we just got the 3 points. This doesn't mean anything unless we beat Cyprus, etc. But it was the moment when you think, right, Ireland have qualified for a World Cup, and a World Cup too, which again, it means a lot more than a European Championship.
Of course, and they would go on to qualify and get into the knockouts, beaten by Spain. The Saipan happened, of course. Keane wasn't there, blah blah blah. And it was, an amazing.
Well, that's
period.
It because the World Cup didn't become. That's why this was this was the pivotal moment, because the World Cup was not the World Cup. Like, there was a famous line from Damien Duff during the World Cup after Saipan, when they were, the build up to the first match, and he had this long, exhausting week and negotiations, would Keane come back, all this kind of stuff. And Duff said, in a press conference, he said, I said to this isn't how I remember the World Cups when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like, everyone had gone to it thinking, we're going to have another carnival. It's going to be another great.
Another 1990.
Another 1990, another orgy of celebration. And instead it became a kind of sporting civil war. I remember I was out there, but I remember a friend of mine in Dublin at the time telling me he walked down a street at the height of it, and he walked past about four or five people and a pub, And every conversation was people talking. All you could hear was Roy Keane Saipan. You walk by people in the street, it was what they were talking about. It became, this was the entirety of the conversation around the World Cup. And then when the World Cup began, it coloured it and it soured it. And it didn't, so it, even when they got to the knockout stages, even when they, drew with Germany, got a last minute equaliser, there was this sense of what might have been, might have been if Keane was there. And then, against Spain, Mick McCarthy didn't realise Spain had 10 men on the field in extra time, which became another.
Hey, but he got his one all draw.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
So this was the moment. This was the. And it was a kind of. It does seem like my favourite moment of that whole day was. Our England played the same day. England played Germany in Munich that night.
Was that the same day?
The same day. Mm. And I remember watching it in a pub in Leeson Street, and my brother was there as well. And he was outside on the phone to his girlfriend at the time, who was saying, you've been at the Ireland game, and now you're watching. Are you going to? When are you? Are we going to do anything tonight this weekend apart from you watching football? And as he was talking to her, Roy Keane walked by.
Right.
And he was heading to the Burlington where the Dutch team were staying to see Jaap Stam. And he walked by. My brother said, I've got to go. Roy Keane has just walked by.
Incredible.
So, while this city was exploding with celebration, Keane was kind of just wandering the street, just on his own, wandering the streets. And, for me, that was a kind of that symbolized an awful lot of how he was. Separate from the hysteria, again, for reasons that weren't to do with, I'm a professional, this was just three points. We're actually Keane separating himself from a lot of the madness he would have previously have indulged in. And here he was, 6 hours later, just walking along a street in Dublin.
Incredible. Dion, it's been a pleasure talking to you about this.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you very much. Great to relive that. Jonathan, a pleasure as always. Thank you very much for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. We're back next week. See you then.
It has to be one of the most courageous, the most brave, the most committed, and ultimately the most effective of Irish performances that we've ever seen. And Mick McCarthy has taken his team, surely, all the way to Korea, and Holland are as good as out.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more. Then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.